Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden, and former White House counsel and NYU law professor, Bob Bauer.
When I was 20 years old in 1972, I interned at the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee and first heard the name Joe Biden as a long-shot candidate for the United States Senate. The staff was skeptical that he could win. Our wily executive director was confident that he would, and he did. He was elected 6 times to the United States Senate and to the Vice Presidency of the United States in 2008 and 2012. But he won over that period of time the biggest election of them all. He won the admiration, the gratitude, and the affection of all Americans. And it's truly bipartisan, this response, as anybody who observed the tribute just yesterday in the United States well knows. So it is with that that I introduce to you the Vice President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Thank you all very, very much. Thank you all very much. I want to make it clear, the main reason why I'm here is Bob Bauer told me to be. And I'm delighted to be here. Bob's a great friend, and his advice is only exceeded in its wisdom by his wife, who has been advising me for a long time as well. And I think Bob's one of the great legal minds as well. This is a man who every piece of legal advice he's given me, I am sure, is consistent with what I decided when I got elected as a 29-year-old kid. I remember sitting with my legal advisors and then sitting with I have the dubious distinction when I filed my campaign finance disclosure as vice president, the lead paragraph in the Washington Post on the front page, and as my wife, the professor, will say, you can Google it. It said, it's probable no man has ever assumed the office of vice president with fewer assets than Joe Biden. I assume they were talking financial and not intellectual. But I would say to the guys helped me with my putative tax return, I'd say, just make sure if the foul line is here, make sure you keep me at least 2 feet behind the foul line. And Bob has kept me behind the foul line. I trust his judgment implicitly. When he asked me to join you all here today, I was really happy to say yes, and I wish I could attend the whole day. You're addressing some of the most interesting and emerging issues of modern-day politics. From the role of big money, which I find corrupting in our political system. I'm the first person to ever introduce legislation as a 30-year-old kid to publicly finance our elections. If you want to change overnight, instantaneously, the electoral process in America and the way we handle issues, have public financing. I guarantee you it would change overnight. I remember seeking the nomination in 2008, and I was in New York at a very high-end fundraiser event for me, which was rare, and we were up in the East 80s at Edgar Bronfman's home. And the elite of the Democratic Party in New York were there. And one fella asked me, who I'll not mention his name, he said, Mr. Chairman, do you talk to ordinary people? And I said, do you think I'd be here with you if I didn't need your money? Which I've been a great fundraiser. It helped me a lot. Ted Kaufman, Senator Kaufman, just about collapsed at the time. But the point is that I hope you spend some time, and really some of you students, focus on the role of money in the electoral process. And, you're also going to be talking about how the nature of, in my generation, Rod McLuhan used to say, the medium is the message. Well, the medium has changed drastically in terms of how we communicate and how we absorb news and how we seek news. It is, and I don't think, I know the baby boom generation hadn't caught up with them. Quite frank, I don't think the millennials have either. There is no editorial filter that exists at all. that's both good and bad. It's going to determine an awful lot about how news is absorbed. It's, you know, we kind of self-select these days. We watch what we agree with. Folks who are conservative Republicans, I doubt whether they watch much of CNN or MSNBC. Liberal Democrats don't watch a whole lot of Fox News except for self-defense. But I'm serious. Think about it. Think about how cabined our consumption of news is. And think about the fact that 4 years ago, more people got their news under the age of 40 from Jon Stewart than any other single medium in the country. And so it's neither good nor bad, but it is a change. It's a change in the way we can generate, how to generate consensus in American politics. And you're also, this has been a very tough election. It's been ugly. It's been divisive. It's been coarse. It's been dispiriting. And it was more a battle of personalities than it was ideas, in my view. As Vice President of the United States, I've traveled over 200,000 miles, traveling to meet with virtually every major head of state in the world. I've been doing this a long time. I know I've met every single one. I think every major head of state in the last 35 years, not because I'm important, it just happened to be the jobs I had at the moment. And I find myself embarrassed by the nature and the way in which this campaign was conducted. You know, so much for the shining city on the hill. But the fact of it is that I know there's a sense in the country that maybe, though, the things are worse off than they really are. There's a sense that the country, that our institutions aren't working, and maybe we can never get them to work. For a lot of folks, it feels as if we're more divided than we ever have been in our history, and that the election brought out the worst in the political system. But, you know, I think this is a time to bring a little perspective to the, probably the only thing I can do, having hung around as long as I have, is try to bring some perspective to the moment. I had a chance to reflect on a number of these issues when I was asked, the great honor, my only political hero I ever had in my career, and I mean this without exception, was Robert Kennedy. He was the only person I respected a lot of people, the only person who was a hero of mine when I was in college and I was in law school. And I had a great honor receiving the Ripple of Hope Award from Ethel Kennedy and the Robert Kennedy at the Robert Kennedy Human Rights Center dinner on Tuesday night. And there were two other awardees more deserving than me, but one of them got up and made a very, very compelling speech about how everything is broken and he's so worried and things have never been the same. A brilliant guy, for real. It was a serious, serious speech. And I was prepared to and asked to talk about how Robert Kennedy, by his daughter Carrie, how Robert Kennedy's life influenced my career at every stage of my career. And so I was prepared. I started off and I was prepared to talk about when I first became acquainted with him. Really, it was as a high school senior when. A junior when President Kennedy got elected and he got appointed Attorney General. And I was prepared to go through how I followed him and when he was in the administration and then when he ran for president, et cetera. And I started to think about it. Things were a hell of a lot worse then than they are now. The nation was a hell of a lot more divided than we are now. And on November 22nd, 1963, when I was a sophomore in college, I was sitting in the steps of what was called Hullion Hall at my university, University of Delaware, in a warm November day. We heard that our hero, the generational hero, John Kennedy, had been assassinated. It was stunning, absolutely stunning, because he was the guy that convinced my generation almost overnight that politics was noble. that we could fundamentally change the trajectory of the nation. That there wasn't much we couldn't do. When I graduated, the Vietnam War was raging. There were serious, serious divisions. Family members did not speak to one another. Your best friends split on the issue. Some deciding to head to Canada, others deciding that this was a noble endeavor and to move, and most of us thinking it didn't make sense, but we were ready to go because that's what we were supposed to do. My last year in law school, 1968, January of that year, after being told the war is coming to an end, the Tet Offensive occurred. And all of a sudden, there was a great comedian then, wry and outlandish comedian named Lenny Bruce, because they kept been talking about the previous 2 years, the light at the end of the tunnel. He said, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. It's a freight train. And it was a freight train, a train that ran over a man who dreamt of being president his whole life, but concluded after the Tet Offensive on May 31st that he was not going to run for re-election. Lyndon Johnson did something that no one who ever known him his whole life ever thought was within the possibility that he would walk away from power. March 4th, I had just gone to my physical for my draft board, and I was waiting in the airport in Syracuse, New York, for a package to come from home, sitting in the parking lot of Hancock Airport, and heard Dr. King had been assassinated. I got engaged in public life because of Dr. King. My state was segregated by law. My state was a border state. My state still had Mrs. Murphy's rule on housing. You could not discriminate against anyone seeking a room unless you had four or fewer rooms in your house. It wasn't until 1968 we elected the first black state senator. That's how I got involved in sit-ins when I was in high school, in college, in law school. He's assassinated. My city was one of those cities partially burned to the ground. My hometown, I was going to go home to in June, Wilmington, Delaware, was the only city in America since Reconstruction occupied by the military for 7 months, with military on every corner with drawn bayonets. On June 6th, I graduated. And shortly after I strode across that stage to accept my diploma, my only political hero was murdered after being named the putative nominee for the Democratic Party. Imagine, those of you who are in school here, imagine if in the last primary that determined Barack to be the president, had he been assassinated. Imagine. Imagine what would have happened. In August, the Democratic Convention, more than 10,000 protesters clashed in the streets for the whole world to see with 20,000 policemen and National Guard. It was chaos. It was chaos. The 70s, things continued to break. As a young public defender, after having gotten a job with the most prestigious law firm in the state, the oldest law firm, a white shoe firm, as we used to say, after 6 months of being there, I realized I couldn't do it. And to the chagrin of all my parents and everyone who knew me, I walked across, those of you who've done federal cases in Delaware, and a lot of corporate cases are done there. I walked across Rodney Square from the federal courthouse after just having won. I didn't win. I sat second chair with the senior partner, a major case for Catalytic Construction Company and Getty Oil.
I walked across the square into the basement of the building, and it was catty corner. And I asked for a job as a public defender. I'll never forget what Franny Kearns, the guy who ran it, looked at me and said, "Don't you work for Prickett?" I said, "Do you know what you're doing?" I knew what I was doing. On May 4th, 1970, peaceful protesters at Kent State were gunned down by the National Guard. 4 students killed, 9 wounded during an anti-war protest. And as an old saying goes, you think you have it tough now. Imagine. Imagine that now. May 15th, 1972, when I was the putative nominee for the Democratic Party at 29 years old, George Wallace, running for president, was shot, nearly killed, permanently incapacitated in Laurel, Maryland. As a lot of my colleagues said yesterday, I didn't realize they knew it as much, but I used to stutter very badly, and I worked very, very hard to overcome my stuttering. And I had an uncle who was an intellectual and a student of Irish poetry, who was a bachelor and stayed with us off and on for long periods of time because he was a salesman for Eastern Pennsylvania. He was from Scranton, but he'd come down and stay with us when he was working the Southern District of his first company. And he always had a book of poetry of Yeats and would sit on my dresser in the room. That we know Horatio Alger's story. We were typical middle class, a 3-bedroom house, 4 kids, and a relative always living with us. Not a joke, always. It was a great way to be raised, by the way. Looking back on it, it was awful hard on my parents, but it was great for us. I used to stand in front of the mirror with a flashlight, trying to, at night, in the 2 sets of bunks, in my 2 brothers and me and my uncle when he came and stayed. And I'd stand in front of the mirror when they were asleep, and I'd take out that book of Yeats poetry, and I'd read it, and I'd kind of try to watch my face to make sure I didn't contort my face, because when you stutter. And if you notice, a lot of you are smiling. It's the only affliction you can smile about. If I was telling you about I had a cleft palate, you wouldn't smile. It's an incredibly debilitating thing. It's awful hard to walk up to the pretty girl and say, "Will you go to the prom with me?" People think you're not smart. So I used to, my colleagues in the Senate for the 36 years I served, they would kid me because I always was quoting Irish poetry, just because I read it so much. And one of Yeats's poems, I remember thinking, as I was married at this time, Yeats's poem, "The Second Coming." He said, "Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. Blood dim tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity." Some would argue that best described my generation and our country, as they say, when I was coming up. My whole generation was basically told, "Don't trust anybody over 30, and it wasn't a joke, and drop out. Drop out. It didn't seem possible the center would hold, but because we thought it was all about to spiral out of control. But we made it through that year and those years, and that whole era. America was divided, but it didn't come apart. It didn't come apart. And I thought then, as I think now, I believe we could change things. I truly believed, and I would argue I was proven correct, that we could change things. And we did in a matter of 4 or 5 years. We ended that damn war. We brought everybody home. We gave voice, finally, to fulfillment of the civil rights movement. The women's movement came into full and clear view and was no longer viewed the province of radicals like me and women's organizations. We made a hell of a lot of progress because the march, to paraphrase King, the arc of history in this country in particular, is always toward progress. We made a lot of progress. Ending, I might add, on January the 18th, my standing on the platform at the Wilmington train station, the same place I used to go as a public defender to interview my clients who'd been arrested by the National Guard. I remember standing on a platform with over 25,000 people down below in the street waiting for a black man to take a 28-minute ride from Philadelphia to pick an Irish Catholic kid up from a middle-class neighborhood, to take a 129-mile ride to be sworn in as President and Vice President of the United States of America. And I was standing with my two boys and my daughter overlooking what they called the Third Street Bridge in the east side that had been burned to the ground. I stood there almost 40 years before, almost to the day, because that's when I joined the Public Defender's Office in mid-January. And I said, boys, don't tell me there's not progress in America. Don't tell me, because at the time, when I stood there, I wondered, will we ever, ever, ever be able to live together? So folks, you know, one of the reasons I liked Robert Kennedy was how he'd always quote George Bernard Shaw, "You see things as they are, say why. I dream things that never were and say why not." I believed it then. I believe it now. I've served longer than all but 13 people in American history in the United States Senate, which is frightening. I can't be that old. But I really mean it. And you know, I believe in the resiliency of the American people and the fundamental, basic, decent instincts of average Americans who are capable of doing extraordinary things. My dad used to say there are two basic principles that all Americans agree with. My dad was a well-read, high school educated man. His great regret was he never went to college. And he said there's two things everybody basically agrees with, Joey. One, that everyone is entitled to be treated with dignity, no matter who they are. And he would just say, and by the way, it's just simply good manners. It wasn't complicated. Most wealthy people believe that. Poor people believe that. Most people in their gut intuitively know that. Don't always do it, but the vast majority of ordinary Americans know that. And he'd say that, and the one thing Americans agree on is their abhorrence for the abuse of power, whether it is economic, political, or physical. And I know now the debate going on in my party and outside the party, which is normal. After every loss, there's a recalculation. Why did we lose? What should we do differently? Notwithstanding the fact Hillary got 2.5 million more votes than the other team, we talk about this as if there's this chasm now that is so wide. And it's described in terms of as if there was a fault line down the middle of the country and the coasts split. We're now a bicoastal party, we're told. A bicoastal nation. Translated, the folks on the coast are much more interested in progressive issues, immigration, LGBT rights, climate change, than they are in the plight of those who are left behind in the middle class. All those white boys out there and those white women living in exurbs and suburbs. And you know, my career, I've never found there being any inconsistency with the concerns about and difficulties of working Americans and being progressive. I say this only for those of you who don't know my career, but elected the Senate 7 times, served only 6 terms, I had to leave to become vice president. But I've been rated by those rating agencies, 1 of the 3 to 7, depending on what the agency is, the most progressive senator in the entire time I served. I didn't have to be in a position where my position on LGBT evolved. It evolved when I was 17 years old. I will compare my role in civil rights, civil liberties, women's issues to anybody I served with in all those years. But I'm also characterized in this town and other places as middle class Joe. Now I'm sure you're the exception, but for most audiences in Washington, that's not meant as a compliment. That's usually meant that he's not that sophisticated. But I'm pretty damn sophisticated about what's made this country what it is. And it's the middle class. Middle class has held the social fabric of this country together when other countries it's frayed. The middle class is an aspirational notion. It's pretty straightforward. During the campaign, I spent a lot of time in union halls in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin. I did over 83 events in this last campaign. 50 uniquely Hillary, 30 uniquely Hillary, 50 for the party, which always included Hillary. And I talked about how we need to change the culture about how we protect women from violence in this country. And union guys would cheer. This idea that all these blue-collar guys are a bunch of racist and sexist is simply not true. It is simply not true. I was recently in Youngstown, Ohio, at an automobile plant. Absolutely packed house. And I started talking about equal pay for equal women, and a resounding cheer went up. You know why? Some of us so sophisticated people in Washington don't get it. Their wives work, and when they don't get paid well, their standard of living decreases. It's not complicated. It's not complicated. I talked about my passion to end violence against women. And on college campus, all those guys had daughters. They cheered. So this idea that somehow what was the base of the Democratic Party is no longer compatible with democratic principles, I reject. And I might point out all those places where our candidate got beat 90-10, 80-20. Barack and I either almost won or only lost. Close. We got 40% of those votes in all those red areas and counties you see. So much for it all being about racism. For me, when I think about the challenges in front of us, I think about the people I grew up with in my neighborhood. Most of all, the American people are full of grit and determination, a sense of fairness, equity, balance. There's no quit in the American people. They get up, they move forward. And I'm really proud of what Barack and I did for the economy. More than 15 million new jobs after losing almost 800,000 jobs the day we got sworn in that month. Lowest unemployment rate since 2007, rescuing the auto industry. But the truth is, because of the changing nature of the economy, globalization, digitalization, use of robots, the depth of this great recession, there's still people that got left behind. My dad used to say, Joey, I don't expect the government to solve my problem, but I do expect them to understand it, to understand my problem. It's not an accident. The highest rate of suicide is white men between the ages of 40 and 55. The greatest abuse of opioids is not in black neighborhoods or barrios. It's those white men. The only cadre of people in America where the life expectancy has gone down in the last 100 years falls in that same category. So you'd think intelligent people would ask themselves, why? Why? What the hell happened? My dad used to say that ever since he had to move from Scranton when there were no work and leave us with my grandpa, and by the way, it was no hardship, we had a great family, everything's fine. I remember when he told me he was going down, he said, look, it's only 157 miles away, honey. I'll try to come home most weekends, and when I get set, we'll bring you, Mom, and the kids down. I remember looking at me and I said, honey, everything's going to be okay. He really believed it. Because there was a basic bargain back then. Both parties agreed, difference in degree, that if you contributed to the well-being of the enterprise with which you worked, you got to share in the profits. That doesn't happen now. For a whole range of reasons. Some of them intended, some unintended, some of the consequence of globalization, a whole range of reasons. And so, I know I got in trouble at the convention when I spoke and I talked about why I thought Hillary would make such a good president, but I did say, we're not paying enough attention to these people. We're not showing enough respect to these people. Globalization is not an unalloyed asset to everybody, as much as we in Washington who know international relations, politics, and the economy think. You know, and quite frankly, even those from middle-class backgrounds, the new elite in America is not the social elite. It's the elite lawyers, elite docs, elite elected public officials, not all, the elite ones, CEOs. And it's based on a merit, it's meritorious. It's black, it's white, women, gays, straight. But there's not a whole lot of connection to the old neighborhood you grew up with. I'll bet I can tell you students or anybody of you work in the administration, I bet I can pick one of four neighborhoods you live in. We tend to congregate with people of like backgrounds. That's normal. And that's a good thing. Not a bad thing. But not a lot, a whole lot of people from my old neighborhood. Here's what we don't think about, in my view. I don't think we about the middle class. It's not just the economic engine of this nation. It's, as I said, it's when it does well, everybody does well. The wealthy do very well. The poor have a way up. There's hope. And as I said, and got some criticism from my own staff because I was I indirectly criticizing the campaign? I wasn't, because I know she agreed with me when I said, we're not showing enough respect. to a segment of the population that is scared to death. Not just because of the effects of the middle class, this sense of loss of wealth, which they did. How many people do you know? I know a lot who never missed a mortgage payment, but the lawn turned brown on either side of them with cockamamie mortgages, and all of a sudden, everything they worked for, the only thing they own, the only equity they had in their home, evaporated. We lost $17 trillion worth of wealth in America, household wealth. We gained back 34. It wasn't because the top 1% are bad guys, but they got about 80% of it. Why? They didn't lose their homes. So the homes went back, they went back. They didn't stop out. They didn't get knocked out of the market. They could stay in. Remember the discussion? The day we got inaugurated, would the market fall below 6,000? Remember that? All those little investors are in there with their little, you know, pension funds and their IRAs. Now it's over 19,000. But guess what? They're not in anymore. But one of the things that bothered me the most was, and I remember I was going into Cleveland, and I was in the plane flying with my staff, and I couldn't understand why I was getting so upset about the election. I mean, there were certain reasons of it, so this was a month out. And I don't know if you ever had one of these sort of epiphanies yourself about what is it really bothering you. And I realized what it was. Elections are supposed to be about referenda on ideas, the direction of the country. So that when a president's elected, they can say, this is what I told you I was going to do. A majority of you basically agree with me. This is what I'm going to try to do. But other than make America great again and forward together, what do you know about the last election? You're among the most educated people in the country, the most sophisticated audience I could be speaking to, and I'm not being solicitous. I wonder how many of you can tell me what Hillary's plan was for free college education. I wonder how many of you can tell me how we planned on changing the tax structure to make it more equitable. I wonder if you can tell me what the position of either administration candidate was in the South China Sea and how to engage China. And I could go on. And even those of you in a campaign, come up here and I challenge you to tell me the detail. It reminds me of Jim Sasser. Remember him, a great guy from Tennessee? The way he'd always run when there was a spending program. And how are you going to pay for it, Jim? He said, waste, fraud, and abuse. Going to get rid of it. Well, we're going to change the tax structure. We're going to make sure the wealthy pay more. Well, that tells people a lot. And why wasn't there more discussion? Hillary Clinton, in my view, and I'm prejudiced, is the single most qualified candidate on the face of it to run for president of the United States we've had, period. Period. Wasn't she didn't have all these ideas, she did. But the press, some of which is here today, you didn't cover it. Wasn't your fault. When a guy talks about grabbing a woman's private parts, when a guy says some of the incredibly outrageous things were said, it sucks up all the oxygen in the air. I was told there were something like, don't hold me this, press, I'll get the number because I don't remember exactly, but there were 44 times more stories about Hillary's emails than there were about any single issue she talked about. Again, it's not the press's fault. I'm not blaming it. It's just the reality. There was little discussion. And it was a very close election. 120,000 votes, a different outcome. So any number of things could be attributed to why my team lost and their team won. From the director of the FBI to not showing up enough and paying enough attention to people. But the one thing I think is pretty clear is that there wasn't much of a discussion of the issues, even in the debates. And so the reason I bothered to tell you that, and I apologize I'm going on so long, but this means so much to me and I think to the country, is that I really think that I'm still optimistic for this country because we're better positioned than any nation in the world to own the 21st century by a long shot. And now we're going to actually have a chance to have a debate because there's going to be specific individuals and proposals put forward to the Congress, even though the other team controls both houses. And the debate will have to be covered. You know, I guess it was P.T. Barnum who said, you know, there's no such thing as bad publicity. I'm not sure that's true, whoever it was that said it. And Trump says it. It turns out he's pretty damn smart in terms of being able to figure out how to deal with the press. You would have thought some of the things he said would be just ipso facto disqualifying for President of the United States of America. But in such a negative campaign, it seemed to take everybody's eye off the ball. And a debate about was there something in an email versus something in his background that disqualified. And so, you know, I think if you listen to the elections just happened, you might think the world's ending. And but I'm not saying we're where we need to be. We're a long way from that. But I'm telling you that I think now there's going to be a real debate, a real discussion, because those issues, those proposals have come forward either to eliminate or to initiate fundamental changes are going to be debated. They will be covered. The public will hear them, will hear them. And I feel confident about our ideas. Give me one example. This overwhelming desire on the part of the Republican Party to eliminate Obamacare. Oh, man. All of a sudden, as they say in southern Delaware, they've had an altar call. They've seen the Lord. Now what are they going to do? Repeal Obamacare, make it permanent, but not take effect until after the next election. Think about it. Think about it. If it's as bad as it, just repeal it. Have at it right now. Repeal it wholesale. Watch county hospitals go under. Take 20 million people off of health care. Get the press covering, my mother just died because she lost her coverage. All those millions of kids who are on your policies up to age 26 because they can't afford insurance on their own, thrown off. All of a sudden, insurance companies going back to charging women more than men for the same coverage. All of a sudden, pre-existing conditions, oh, they matter? I don't get coverage. So, folks, there's an awful lot that was said. I welcome the debate. I can hardly wait. No. I'm not being a wise guy. I really mean it. I can hardly wait to engage this debate. And you're going to see the American people begin to refocus again because there will be a focus. It will not solve all the problems. We're not going to have the answer to globalization in the next 6 months or year. We're not going to figure out how to deal with digitalization. I was a keynote speaker at Davos last year. Over 2,800 CEOs, I was told, and over 88 heads of state. And they gave me an easy topic. Klaus asked me to speak to, quote, the fourth industrial revolution. Will there be a middle class? Every other major industrial revolution we've had has resulted in, over time, the ability to mold it to not just benefit a few, but to benefit all of humanity and raise it up. To vastly oversimplify, in the interest of time, I would say we're probably about where we were in the Industrial Revolution in England when the Luddites were wandering the Midlands smashing the machinery. Not a joke. All of society was turned upside down in that revolution. A big piece of society is not completely turned upside down, but is fractious, afraid, uncertain, and waiting to figure out how will this benefit me. You know, I told you I was at, I'll end with this. I told you I went to the receive that award at the Robert Kennedy Foundation. And the Medicare, the Affordable Care Act, the infrastructure, how to pay for it, college education, all those things, retraining and jobs, the things we're now going to be actually having to discuss and people are going to listen to. Robert Kennedy was talking about some versions of those things back when he was running. And, one of the things he always argued about, or is for, he said, we don't listen enough. We don't listen to the other person's perspective. It's understandable, human nature. But, he used to talk about it. And I remember when he went to South Africa. And the South African government, it was said, I'm not going to give you any police protection. You'll have no coverage. And Ethel went with him. And he went and he met with the pro-apartheid parishioners and anti-apartheid activists. He dined with the government officials, the Afrikaner government, who defended the indefensible. And he sat with students who were risking their very lives to change the system. And here's what he said. He said, I come not simply to criticize, but to engage in a dialogue, to see if together we could elevate reason above prejudice and myth. He did that same thing the next year in the middle of the deadly battle for civil rights in Greenville, Mississippi, in Bed-Stuy, New York, and a year after in the fight for economic rights in Kentucky coal country. He went to see the segregation and poverty was ripping apart our country, but he always listened, even to those who fundamentally disagreed with him. In individual conversations, lost large crowds, across mountains, rough mountains, schoolhouses, inner cities. His purpose for all those trips he made were to listen and to let people know he was listening. Even if they didn't vote for him, even if they didn't like him, he listened. And he felt their pain. He understood their perspective. So I think the most important thing we have to start doing in and out of government is start to listen to one another again. Because the simple truth is, we don't listen very much anymore. I'll conclude by saying the one fun I'm always asked, what's the biggest change since you entered the Senate when you were a kid? When I entered the Senate when we were a kid, I said how divided we were. You know, we had all the old segregationists were still in the Democratic caucus. James O. Easton, Mississippi. John McClellan, meanest SOB I ever served with. Harry F. Byrd, Virginia. I go down the list. They were all still there. They were all still there. But you know what? After I was there a while, it's amazing how when even the other, quote, the bad guys listened. By the time Strom Thurmond left the Senate, he had the largest African-American staff of anybody in the United States Senate, including Teddy Kennedy. he voted for the extension of the Voting Rights Act. On his deathbed at age 100, I got a call from the hospital. Would I do his eulogy? I was his eulogist. I ran for the Senate because I was against everything Strom Thurmond stood for. I was honest in the eulogy too. I didn't paint a rosy picture. But he changed. Long time in coming. Long time in coming. Jesse Helms, a man who was most bitter of all the people I got elected with, he ended up saying awful things about African Americans. I mean, just flat racist things. And he said 2 years before he left, he had to do it all over again. He'd go to Africa to be a missionary because he was wrong. Chris Dodd and I were the only two people that showed up to his funeral in North Carolina, a big box church, a big Baptist box church, and a side room, a reception room, where all the senators went in to meet the family as they walked out before the service started. I'll never forget Dodd Helms walking out. Two really bright and really beautiful daughters who was 50-some years old now, in braces up to his hips, and steel braces on both arms, who they adopted in that same condition and not when he was 14 years old. And they walked out, and I stepped back from to meet the Republican leadership, and they literally walked up to me and said, Joe, we put your sign on our lawn for president, you and Barack Obama. We voted for you. We voted for you. I don't expect epiphanies to occur. And some of this takes a long, long time. And I'm not trying to paint Jesse Helms or Strom Thurmond into being saints. They did some terrible things, in my view. And I voted against them constantly. But if you listen, if you listen to the other guy's perspective, it's amazing what happens. It takes patience, but it's hard. We don't listen much anymore. You know, I learned a lesson from Senator Mike Mansfield when I was a kid. He said I got elected when I was 29. On November 7th, I didn't become eligible to be sworn in until November 20th. And December 18th, my wife was Christmas shopping. I was checked her trailer broadside. I'm going to kill my wife, kill my daughter. My two boys were very badly injured. And I decided I wasn't going to go to the Senate, where the Democratic governor could appoint a successor. And a bipartisan group of people, including Mike Mansfield and Hubert Humphrey and Fritz Hollins and Ted Stevens, you know, came to me and said, you gotta come get sworn in, just be there for 6 months, and then help us organize. We had 58 Democratic senators helping me organize. But I used to have to report to the office of the majority leader every Tuesday at 3 o'clock, and I got an assignment. I honest to God thought every senator got assignments from the majority leader. Like I said, I'm the first senator I ever knew. And one day, when I was walking in May, when I was walking in for my meeting, I walked into the floor and Jesse Helms was ripping into Ted Kennedy and Bob Dole on the precursor for the Americans with Disabilities Act, saying we have no obligation, we have no requirement, it's wrong to mandate businesses have curb cuts and elevators, et cetera. And I thought it was heartless. And I walked in, I sat down. I didn't realize until about then that the reason he was seeing me was to take my pulse to see how I was doing, how I was handling going home every day. And he said, what's the matter, Joe? And I went on and I ripped into Jesse Helms. I said, he has no social redeeming value. And I went on and on, and he doesn't care about They looked at me and said, Joe, you know, I found something interesting here. They said, everybody gets sent to the Congress because the public finds something admirable about them. I found it's a better use of your time to try to find out what that is and go after people and question their motive. And then he said, Joe, what would you say if I told you that 3 years earlier, sitting in their living room in Raleigh, reading The Observer, there was an advertisement for a young man, I think 14 at the time, in braces up to his hips in an orphanage saying, all I want for Christmas is someone to love me. I said, what would you say if I told you that Jesse and Dot Helms went down and adopted that young man as their own child? I said, I'd feel foolish. He said, Joe, it's never, never wrong to question another man or woman's judgment and go to war over it. But it's never appropriate to question their motive, because as obvious as it appears, you don't know. And once you question motive, you can never get to go. We do too much of that now. So we should not remain silent one instant when this administration goes after the progressive values we care about. We should not back away one scintilla from the arguments and the merits of all the things we care about. But we should listen, and we should realize the American people are a lot better than they're given credit for right now. And let's go back and speak to the people. As they used to say in my old neighborhood, that brung us to the dance. A lot of those working class people, black and white, are the ones that brought us to the dance. Thanks for listening. Sorry for being so serious, but I think it's a serious time, but I am optimistic. Thank you. Good.